Mud Podcast presents.
Welcome to Mindful Mud. I'm Flavina Nickley, your host. I'm a Zen teacher and mindfulness instructor, and thank you. This show is about different kinds of mindfulness and different ways we can incorporate more mindfulness into our daily lives and make our lives more meaningful. Perhaps today we're definitely going to talk about how to slow them down. very different topics that I introduce on the show. So today I'm feeling really blessed. I have a wonderful guest here with me in the studio, Andy Couturier, right?
Couturier.
Yeah. Between French and Quebecois, I'm going to go in between. Yeah, this is excellent. Thank you so much for being here. We will talk today about his outstanding book. It's called The Abundance of Less. Andy, welcome.
Thank you so much.
All right. I'm going to just introduce you a little bit to our audience. So Andy is the son of a biographer and a civil rights activist. He lived for 4 years in Japan and wrote for the Japan Times while studying the connections between Japanese aesthetics and innovative new forms of writing. In California, he and his partner built their own house using only hand tools, developing a piece of raw land into a functioning rural homestead with solar and hydroelectric power. Andy has studied Buddhist meditation and many other Asian philosophical systems and has traveled extensively in Africa, Southeast Asia, and India. He has been a researcher for Greenpeace and has taught writing for more than 20 years. Is that about right? 20 years or more now?
I think we're at 28 years.
28 years of writing workshops. That's incredible. He's the author of Writing Open the Mind. Tapping the Subconscious to Free the Writing and the Writer. And has written for Adbuster, the MIT Press, the Huffington Post, Creative Nonfiction, the North American View, the Auckland Tribune, Kyoto Journal, Ikebana Journal, and all kinds of things, right? So I'm really happy you're here, Andy. Welcome. This is not even your first time on KMA, right?
No, I've been on several times over the years, yes.
Excellent. Keep that going.
I'd love to.
I love that tradition. All right, but first time on my show, for sure. I just want to, for me personally, thank you for writing this book. You mentioned, I remember we were standing in front of Chautauqua, and you're like, I wrote this book. You might want to read it. And I'm like, oh, cool. So I looked it up, and I got the book, and it was – I don't know. It was definitely a joy to read it, but it was way more. It was deeply nourishing for me. And also, it made me think about so many different aspects of my own life. Hmm. It brought up a lot of questions, a lot of contemplations. And it just really slowed me down. I remember so many evenings just sitting on the couch, like completely content with some tea and the book. And just slowing down. It's almost like the whole message from the book is kind of pouring out the pages. You can feel yourself going with the rhythm of some of these people that you describe in rural Japan, right? So the book is about these lessons in simple living from rural Japan. And he profiles 10 men and women who have left mainstream life in urban Japan to live surrounded by the luxuries of nature, right? And really that nurturing of art, friends, community, nature, gardening, cooking, growing your own food, slowing down.
And activism.
And a lot of huge part is activism.
They're anti-nuclear activists and have been since way before Fukushima.
Right, right. And I think this is just part of like living with nature. It kind of comes out of that, right? Anywho, it's an incredible book, and I feel so nurtured by it. truly on all aspects. So thank you for that. Just, you know, having mentioned a few things, how it is for me, I would like to read actually before you kind of give an inspiration why you read or why you wrote the book. Mm-hmm. I want to read what Bill McKibben wrote about your book. So I'm quoting Bill McKibben. We are in an overheated world, physically and spiritually. It is extremely powerful to read of people who have managed to escape that world, not by traveling to outer space, but by heading toward reality. This is subversive in the best possible way. You know, Andy, did you kind of plan to write a subversive book?
I think I've been subversive since I was born, but I like to think that. And just in case people don't know, Bill McKibben is a climate activist, pretty well known in that world, and one of the founders of 350.org, which works on climate issues, and a writer for New Yorker.
Right. The first time I heard of 350 is actually at a demonstration at Richardson Grove down here.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, what was the inspiration for you to write this book?
Well, my partner and I went to Japan in 1989, and we didn't really expect to find much that we were interested in because we only knew the sort of cliches about blue-suited businessmen and economic miracles and factories, and that's all there. But we also found that there was an older tradition, not only Taoism and Buddhism, but also just things that are embedded in Japanese culture, listening well, even mainstream, folks really good at tuning in to how to get along with each other. And we had gone there because we had intended to purchase some land, and we heard that we could make decent money teaching English. And we were in our 20s and had a couple friends there, and so we just went. And then at some point looking for organic – and we're trying to make money to buy land, which is what we did actually here in the Southern Humboldt area. So that's just kind of a – I'd like to be able to give back to this community where we've had property for 30 years. So when we got to Japan, I was looking for organic food, and then I found out there was a little co-op kind of thing, just like a buying club. And then I met a very intense and challenging woman, which was really a breath of fresh air because there's a lot of, pressure for women to be demure and quiet. And she was really ready to challenge me. And her name was Atsuko Watanabe. And she said, would you and Cindy like to come up on Sunday to our house in the mountains? And if you're an English teacher in Japan, that's like your one day off to not have basic English conversations. So you generally like really guard your Sundays. But for some reason we said yes. And we went out into the countryside, about an hour and a half drive bus, from the medium sized city where we were living in Shikoku, which is the smallest of the four main islands. And as we got out there, we just saw a world we thought might have disappeared 200 years ago. These incredible rice terraces, paddies, kerosene down the mountains, mist clinging to trees, clear open rivers, these old farmhouses. And there, Atsuko and her husband and their two little girls lived in this really rich way, which we recognized right away as, similar to the back to the land folks that we had lived with in Southern Oregon. And that's the reason we wanted to do this. And we were like, oh my God, this is happening in Japan. We walk in the door and we were treated to a 7-course South Indian meal from her husband, not her, Gufu, and we were just like, oh my God. And they'd lived in the subcontinent, and they introduced us to our friends. And at the same time, we were teaching English in, corporate Japan. I was actually, with the contract I got, I had to work for a pharmaceutical company, so I was working with businessmen, teaching them English, and fine people, but you could really see how that industrial mindset and the rush and the expectation and the climbing for status affected them, drained them of their what you say in Japanese, genki, which is original spirit, which you can see in the kids before they go to school. So you start to realize what's happened in urban industrial Japan. A friend of mine said that a Japanese sociologist had said in the 70s that the Japan, and I'm quoting this from my friend, so he said, the Japanese have accomplished what the Nazis could have only dreamed of. And so just this levels of conformity and strictures on everybody's life, it was heartbreaking, frankly. And you could see, you know, of course, in the United States, until today, people are incredibly overbusy. They're overtaxed. They don't get enough sleep. They're working, you know, whether they're in white-collar jobs and trying to get ahead, but particularly working-class people who are very, frankly, oppressed by the system. They don't have any time to dream. They don't have any time for their family. They don't have any time. And here were some people in a society that was quite arguably more restrictive and more hierarchical and more money-oriented than the United States, who had broken free. And I thought, we've got to figure out, I would want to know, how did they do it? What was their psychology? How did they do that? And so that's when I started writing about them. And then I felt like we had to have a book about it.
Yeah, I'm glad you did. So you saw both, right? Working for the corporate Japan, I mean, in corporate Japan, with these, as you said, most likely unhappy, disconnected folks, and then going just an hour or two outside, you know, the countryside, and see this completely different way of being. So then from Atsuko, and so then you met more and more people?
Yes. Yeah, so she helped me out along the way. In some ways, this is also her book. She's an anti-nuclear activist, a mom. She worked with her husband, Gufu, who I also profile in the book. And the book is 10 profiles. Each chapter is a profile of a different person. And then the afterword is about our life here in Southern Trinity, actually, and what we learned from them. But she introduced us to some people that she had lived with in Nepal. And they had had a sort of backpackers community lodge that was run by a disaffected Zen priest who was doing research on Nepali Buddhism, which was fascinating. So this was not the Western gaze on India and Nepal and China. This was other people from the Asian continent taking in what was fascinating to them about India. And they had done some cultural preservation. So they got to know each other, and they were really into food and learning spices and cooking, and they formed a community there in their 20s and 30s in the late 70s and early 80s, and then they later moved back to Japan. So many of the people in the book knew each other through that network, and then I got to meet them.
That's what I thought was fascinating, that, yes, it was rural Japan, right? And then most of them had that deep connection to India and Nepal. First, I was like, wait, how does that work? But yeah, it makes a lot of sense, right? And really that comparison of Hinduism and Buddhism, and then making it into not just talking and reading about it, but actually living it. That's what was so wonderful to really become pretty much part of when you read it. Yeah.
Hmm. And you also, I just want to pick up on, you mentioned you had a lot of questions that came up for you, so feel free to.
Well, just the easy contemplations, right, that came up. Like, for instance, like the other day I was in the garden, and, you know, when you're in a mindset, like in a book, right, you get inspired, and then you start to, like, bring, at least me, and then I bring this into my daily life, right? It just kind of, like, seeps into it. And so I was out in the garden, and I was weeding, and I'm thinking, and I think it was Atsuko, right, who was, like, not even weeding. She was just cutting the weeds.
Yeah, it was Wakako. It was another woman. Chapter 7, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, shall I actually really weed here? Right? So, again, just a question. I don't need an answer. Then another question arose. I was like, am I abusing my soil? Am I greedy with my soil? Like, because I put a winter garden in part of my garden after I had a lot of crop that I pulled out the summer. And I was thinking, am I greedy with the soil? Am I greedy with my own time? Shall I rest in a winter, not garden, and let the soil rest, right? So it's just questions that came up, and not that I need an answer or judge myself, but just because of those questions, I felt deeper connected to what I was doing, and also open to really evaluate my values of like, is this really what I want to do? Or is there another way? Perhaps next year I'm not going to put anything in the winter after September, you know? So I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's just, it gave me a deeper connection to just being with my land, my little piece of land.
Nice.
Yeah, so I really appreciated that. And another thing, for instance, that came up was I spend a lot of time cooking every day. And a lot of the time I'm asking myself, why am I spending like an hour, sometimes two, cooking every day just for two people? And I know why I'm doing it, but sometimes because it gives me deep joy, right?
Right.
It gives me deep happiness to play around with my own grown veggies and spices and smells and herbs and creations. It's my creativity outlet, right? But then my logical sense comes in as like, you don't have time for anything. You know, why are you spending so much time on cooking? You know, that internal voice. So anyway, reading the book, I'm realizing these people, like one of them said, it should be 50%. Our life should be evolving 50% around food. That was Osamu Nakamura, right?
Yes.
So anyway, I thought, oh yeah, that's right. So it's just neat to have this kind of inner conversation with my own values, I guess.
Yeah. So that's in chapter two. His name is Nakamura, Osamu Nakamura, and he's another key person in the book. And he said this thing that was completely challenging. He was like, I read Thoreau, Walden. I'm like, oh my God. You know, they're reading our Back to the Land text. And he's like, I didn't like it much. I'm like, you didn't? He's like, yeah, you seem more like a tourist to me. He only stayed there for 2 years. And then he went, as you do the research, yep, that's true. You know, and I think Thoreau's mom did his laundry. You know, it was weird. But me, he wrote a great book and it was very important. But he's like, it should have been more about food, because living this kind of life has got to be more about cooking and eating. But you wanted me to read a passage here?
Yeah, would you? That would be excellent.
All right. And this is from my book, The Abundance of Less. And if people are wanting to find out more about it, you can just Google that, theabundanceofless.com. There's some excerpts and pictures and stuff like that. But now that you're listening to the radio, enjoy the sound of words. So this is a little introduction. So each chapter has an introduction that I wrote. I tried to not forefront me, but more forefront them. But here's the introduction, as you asked me to read. It's easy to see the benefits of modern production techniques. Convenience, access to an incredible range of goods and services, getting a lot done in a very small amount of time. Machines give us an incredible leverage. What is more difficult to see is what we have lost. Although I had read a lot about the alienation that often accompanies progress, it wasn't until I met the craftsman, Osamu Nakamura, that I could experience exactly how his, quote, simple life and his palpable contact with the physical world is actually so much richer than the hamster wheel lives that so many of us have become accustomed to. By using his hands to provide for his needs, he has found a richness of heart and a sensitivity of perception that so many of us long for.
Yeah. Thank you. It's that connection to our own heart and therefore really becoming open to nature.
And for him and through him, just becoming aware of doing work with our hands and how important that can be. And you know that term manual labor, right? It's almost always said in such a negative way, like anything but, right? But we're actually alienating ourselves from a deep part of our humanity is our relationship with our hands. So he is a woodblock carver. Someone else makes flutes. A couple other people are potters, painters. A lot of them are farmers. So actually doing work with your own hands as opposed to going to the fastest, quickest machine or the push-button device is I found too, just incredibly enriching. Cynthia and I built our house with hand tools, and a number of our neighbors were building their houses at the same time. And one of them was like, you know, let me show you how to use a circular saw. Let me show you, you know, you're just going to get this done a lot quicker. That person has moved away 20 years ago or more. And to us, you know, there's just a deeper, I can't compare him, but, you know, the connection that we have to when it starts to rain and we're warm and the raindrops are hitting the roof and plucking, it's like plucking the pillow of the roof, and that we did that with our own hands. And now quite some years ago, like almost 30 years ago, you know, that handwork is, you know, continuing to sustain us. It's a richness that I'd love more people to be able to experience.
Yeah, how true. It just reminds me of when I was very young, in my early 20s, I used to escape. When I was still living in Switzerland, my parents had a little cottage up in the Alps, and there was just a water in front of the house, and you had to heat the, you know, you had to chop wood and carry water, basically. And I would used to escape there because you had to walk up. You couldn't even drive up to the cottage. And that was just such a coming back to myself and to that sense of life and being alive, that I just kept escaping up there as much as I could. And, you know, reading that reminded me a lot of that. It just gives you that value and that intensity of being alive in a very different way. And the book is full of that, right? In all ways. Yeah, for sure.
And you mentioned this is a call-in show, so people could call in?
Yes, we could open the call, the phone lines. That would be fine. So if you're curious and have a question for Andy Couturier, that would be fine. You can call in. Julian puts you on the air. The phone number here is 707-923-3911. We're talking about the abundance of less, reconnecting with what's important in life, I would call this, right? Simplicity, slowing down. And if you have a question for Andy, please call in.
Yeah, I would just say a little bit about what's important in life. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be a preacher and say, you know, if you are into, you know, motocross biking, you know, or you are into
big time. Yeah.
I don't know, whatever it is. And it does involve, you know, it's not that, you know, everyone has to live a particular way. And I'm trying to be careful in the book to not say, you know, this is what's important.
I'm really glad you bring that up, Andy. It's really true, because it's not about feeling judged. It's about feeling inspired.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and I do feel a lot of folks are, you know, there is so much emptiness going on in the world and so much disconnect and perhaps just even sanity. I mean, if we're looking at what's going on politically, right, the insanity of us destroying our own habitat, destroying each other, it's that disconnect and coming. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just had an insight about that, and it's not necessarily in the book, but it's recent. I think not only do we have currently a part of the economy that's based on chaos, and Naomi Klein has written about that, you know, that's actually disaster capitalism. We also have an economy that's based on trauma, like it actually makes money for certain industries and certain people, and it makes money on increasing insanity. So it's one of the reasons why I'm not tracking everything that's happening politically right now. I'll go to every protest I can, but I'm not going to, you know, it's the environmental movement of the mind. So I try to not participate in the things that are actually trying to promote craziness.
And this is exactly what is the book is the opposite of, like, really broadcasting these incredible opportunities and ways that we can live sustainably, deeply sustainably, and deeply happy and nourished, if that's, you know, and then also, I mean, these are I don't know if I should say extreme examples, but really like, yeah, I mean, they really took it all the way, right? But I think taking what inspires us out of it and start influencing it and bringing it into our own life is really where it's at. Mm. And that's kind of what you have been doing, right? Obviously.
I'm trying to, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think we all, in a way, crave it. We just don't know it's available.
Or we're in a habit pattern that, you know, and there's a lot of trances going on. So breaking that trance.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
Slow down, and when we go deeply into something we love, and as you said, it can be something completely different, like, I don't know, cleaning a house or like whatever your job is, or, you know, but taking that, and it's kind of that Zen way even, right, where you really take what you do and you become deeply present with it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
There's such a satisfaction in that. Yeah. And this is a reminder. I have here with me Andy Couturier, and we're talking about his book, The Abundance of Less. Yes, there are so many wonderful people in this book. Do you want to read another passage?
Sure. Why don't you choose one you'd like to hear?
Let's see. We have so many people here. How about we're talking about Erika Ito?
Akira Ito.
Thank you.
Right.
186.
Okay.
This is a 400-page book. And and it's wonderful to slow down and read it. Like, I really took my sweet time to read it.
Yeah.
And it's, again, it's like one of those things that you just, it's perfect now for the winter to just curl up and, yeah, get nourished.
A little about the length of the book. I've just finished an even longer book, which I can tell you about. But, you know, a lot of people said, oh, could you know, make it shorter, have, you know, go to 6 different countries, you know, publishing people. And I just believed that I wanted to give these people room to speak. And, yeah, it is a long book, but I get emails from people who say, you know, the day I finished the last page, I started again, or I've been reading a little bit of it every day for 4 years. So, I tried to put a lot of love in it. So, but you can also just read, you can open up to a chapter that you like and say, you know, I'm interested in pottery, or this one's about a mother, you know, and you can just read that chapter. You don't have to read the whole book all the way through.
I think for me, it lives on that length in the way of it really takes you into that journey and getting to know the land a little bit. And how you describe the land is just so incredibly beautiful. Like, that itself is just really what I enjoyed. It's not the information necessarily. I mean, that's beautiful too. All the, you get to, you know, you kind of get to go to Nepal and India and learn about those cultures and train rides over there. So there's a lot in there. But again, for me, it was about the smell when you came into a house, right? And what was hanging and what was drying and their harvests. That's really what made the book so special.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll just say a little about the writing, and mm-hmm. I'll read the passage that you liked. I teach writing. That's what I've been doing for years, and I try to make the writing classes really slow. And I took a good part of 20 years writing this book, you know, and just there would be times where there would be a quality in the person's dining room that was so rich, and you just have to take the time to kind of write it and you know, I'm not quite there yet, not castigating yourself as a bad writer, but like, okay, this is something I just want to go deeper into and I want to go deeper into. And so anyway, I think that if there's quality there, it's the quality of setting up my life so I had the time, and then devoting the time to trying to capture these places. Okay, so this is a man named Akira Ito, I-T-O, And he's the elder in the book. He was born in 1935. And in many ways, he was the leader or teacher for many of the other people. And this is about his – so he, you know, 1935, so he was given a militarist education during the 40s. And then afterwards, there was a huge change in the Japanese economy, and many people could not survive in the countryside anymore, and they were forced into the cities, and they were forced into salaried work, and there was this huge expansion in the Japanese economy at the time, and he became a petroleum engineer. So these are not just middle-class people who are living, you know, boutique lives and, you know, purchasing tchotchkes. You know, these are people who come from all walks of life and from urban areas. So here we go. At 28, he gave up that high status life as an engineer, its money and its security, to begin a journey that led him through being an itinerant artist and philosopher, and later to living in this house in the woods near the slopes of Mount Fuji, in order to follow in the footsteps of the Chinese mountain literati of ancient times. His choice to try to wrest freedom from a society not accustomed to granting it easily says to me that Ito was somehow able to break the dual trances of achievement and money that so many people today are living snugly inside of.
Yeah. And it's really remarkable. Each one of these people has their own story or their own drive, right? Why they did it. And, like, what do you think was some of the you know them deeply, all of them, right? What are some of that inspiration came from?
Well, that was really important. And my partner calls this a book of internal sustainability. Like, what is it inside of us that allows us to live more sustainably? So for him, he experienced the American firebombing of Japanese cities. The city next to his was burned to the ground when he was, I don't know, 8 or 9. And he started giving deep thought to the question, what happens when we die? Where do we come from? Doko kara dokoe, which is Japanese for where from, where to. Like, before we were here, where were we? And when we leave, where do we go? And he felt that he needed to – he just couldn't live with not trying to find an answer to that question. And so – he was at first driven to art. He's actually a very interesting artist and a children's book illustrator, but he also worked in publishing for years, publishing children's books. But he traveled all over Europe and traced the footsteps of his teacher, and then lived in India for a long time. And through that, he was looking for what he called a viewing platform on the whole world. And he arrived in Kathmandu to the Bodha Temple, which I just visited recently a couple of years ago. And he said, I finally found here this thing I had always been looking for, somewhere where I could see with the compassionate eyes of the Buddha all the suffering of the world and try to alleviate it. So as compared to working as a petroleum engineer and trying to increase profits for some company, he thought that was a much richer way to live his life. So there was a draw towards that, but also for him, quite a fierce hatred of how everything is changing so quickly and how the things of the past were being discarded, the really rich objects, ways of life, artistic techniques were being discarded and abandoned. And it happened very quickly in Japan. Like, when we first got there in 89, 90, most of the people who were older in the countryside had grown up using almost no cash. People in their 70s and 80s, you know, they lived in an almost cashless world. My grandparents, my great-grandparents, they all lived in a world of cash, and they did for themselves. So I think that was a big motivation for him. I can answer about other people if you want.
I just find it's really that question of finding our own inner motivation for life, period, and then take it from there, right? And I think many times it's really that pausing again and looking at, why am I here? What do I really want? And not just, as you said, like being in the habit of just being a working member of the society and do what's expected from me. And they're a couple, like, really, these people have paused big time and found their own way. Yeah, it's remarkable, for sure. And it gives us this freedom and inspiration to do the same, right? And I feel like, to a certain extent, I've always done that, as you said. I'm kind of born as that, right? As you said for yourself, it's like... And I feel the same for me. And at the same time, it's that refinement, right? Of keep asking ourselves, okay, how can I refine my own way of living? So I get deeper and deeper to who I really am. Yeah. Yeah. So it's a great angle this book can give us from, like, really how to be with these practices, not just read it. Yeah. And there's this quote from Akira Ito. In each season, while I sketch and put down the shapes and forms of plants, flowers, animals, and bugs, embraced by the life of the forest, I sometimes experience a complete unification with the forest and all its life. These times are truly times of bliss for me. Right? It's like this finding really what they were looking for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So did you have any disputes, Florina, with this book? Did something come up that you wanted to challenge or disagree with or add to?
Almost. It was almost where I was like, okay, this is getting a little too pure, right? This is getting a little too, like, how should we live kind of flavorish, right?
Okay.
And then, but as soon as I thought that, then there was the sentence, obviously, of like, this is not about becoming pure. And I'm like, oh, thank God. Because, you know, as you said, you know, it's not about becoming like, I'm going to say that, another, oh, I should. Mm-hmm. But it's really about, for me, nurturing the inspiration.
And the pleasure of life. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll bring in something a little edgy,
yeah,
edgy on that. So, I'm Jewish on my mom's side. So this whole, like, purity myth, you know, that's the word that was used by Adolf Hitler, right? You know, we're going to purify the race. So all of this purification thing, every time I hear that word, it's like, you know, even in certain strands of Hindu philosophy and Hindu practice, you know, that I came upon in India, there's this sense of, you know, let's get to this pure light. And so to me, these people are living, you know, with a series of compromises with the circumstances they live in, as I do. Like, I teach writing. Everyone's like, oh, you're living close to the land. Like, I spend a lot of time on – there's some calls. I spend a lot of time on Zoom teaching my writing classes. I don't feel bad about that. I have a real nice connection. But so just, you know, it's not about that.
Yeah. Shall we take a caller? All right. Caller,
welcome. Oh, thanks for being there. Well, I didn't know what I was going to say. It changed when I heard you use the word purity, because I do think that that does exist. Well, no, I don't think it exists. I know it exists because I watch animals.
Interesting.
Trees and clouds. They never tell a lie. And so to me, purity is getting to a place where you feel comfortable with yourself and you're not going to ever tell a lie again, or you're not going to listen to one.
That's beautiful.
And I love that. Happen to know, because I've experienced freedom, that we came here to be free. I mean, that's our natural existence. Only, you know, we allowed that to be, you know, We were divided and conquered, and we allowed that to go. But I see it definitely coming back. And I'm so grateful for programs like this, where we have these conversations that are gentle and pure. I consider them pure.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
That's
so much.
Nice. Yeah, thanks for your call.
Thank you, caller.
And, I mean... I work with words all the time. So this question of definition. But I really appreciate you bringing that in, the clouds and animals. But I think just to kind of soften up on ourselves and not use, say, the example of someone that we, you know, admire, Gandhi or something like that, and think, you know, we're not I'm not living like Gandhi, and using that as an opportunity to be, you know, introduce negativity towards ourselves. I think that's what I'm mostly talking about. But I really loved your comment, and I don't disagree.
Do we have another caller? Okay, caller, you're in the air. Welcome to Mindful Mud.
Hello.
It's you.
Yes, this is David, Andy.
Oh, hi.
How are you?
I'm good.
You know who I am, right?
I know so many Davids. Please tell me.
How about Nopo? How about David Anthony?
Oh, my God, David Anthony. Sorry, I didn't recognize your voice right away. Wonderful.
Here's what I would like to explore.
Yes.
You have told the listening audience only a part of the story of this book. It had another life with another title.
That's true.
A Different Kind of Luxury, published in 2010.
That's correct, yeah.
So what is the relationship between these two books? It's not just a matter of reprinting, is it?
Thanks for the question. Originally the series in the Japan Times was called Alternative Luxuries, and everyone changed it into Alternative Lifestyles. And they're like, oh, yeah, Alternative Lifestyles. And so I actually think this is not a lifestyle. I think it's a way of life. So styles are sort of like bell-bottom jeans or, you know, particular bouffant hairdos. So I called it a different kind of luxury, and trying to emphasize the richness of this life, because sometimes simplicity is either marketed or castigated as this austerity practice, which is actually an interesting practice. I want to say abnegation has a really important role, and I think you can learn a lot through it. But I also wanted to try to entice people in with that title, A Different Kind of Luxury, into seeing that they could live a more ecologically sound life with much less production and much more time for themselves, and, you know, less destruction of the earth, and that could be a luxurious lifestyle, way of life. I say it myself. So the book came out in 2010, and it's slightly different. This is The Abundance of Less is a reprint in 2017. And the new publisher wanted to include something. In fact, they would not publish it unless I wrote about our lives in the country. And so I didn't really want the book to be about a white guy goes to Asia and, you know, discovers himself, and, you know, the people that he meets are peripheral, which I find offensive. And especially because I do not think that, you know, my way of life is as exemplary as theirs is. I consented in order to get it published. And it's actually great because one of my friends and a mentor of mine, even though she was originally a writing student of mine, said, what's interesting is how do you, living in this set of circumstances, try to bring these concepts or values into your daily life and your struggle against it? And that was what I put in the afterword. Another difference is that I did an update on each person. So you know, about 7 or 8 years later, I traveled back to Japan. They were getting older. And there's like 4 to 6 pages at the end of each chapter talking about their reflection. A couple of them had passed away on their lives and what was important. In terms of the change of title, the new publisher thought, you know, with that French name, Couturier, and the word luxury and the way things are sold on the internet, people could get the totally wrong idea, you know, Couturier, luxury, and not draw in the kind of people who would be interested in the book. So I'm not sure if I've answered your question fully, David, but if there's something, if you want
you.
Your point towards something else, you're welcome to do so.
No, that was perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
David. I just wanted people to know that the book has had more than one life.
Yeah, and David's a friend of mine and a wonderful writer who writes on African-American history and African history, and it's just been a joy to work with different kinds of people in writing classes. Go ahead, Florina.
Oh, I just thought that's a really excellent question from the caller, and I so much appreciated that. Again, it gave me the time in the book of, like, afterwards reading about what happened with them after, you know, like when they got older and how they were doing. And because you really start to create that relationship with these people. So I thought that was very neat. It gives this space that I really appreciated this time. I don't know. Shall we read something from Atsuko Watanabe?
Sure. Okay. So
she's an interesting.
The page. Tell me what you liked about Atsuko.
Oh, a lot. Especially, I mean, she and Gufu. I mean, Gufu is such an incredible person as well. And just their fierceness, in a way, of really being with their kids. And, I mean, in a very gentle way, fierce and gentle way, and the land and their own selves. And anyway, just really, really inspiring.
So I'm childless, my partner and I, voluntarily childless. But I wanted to really include both the older generation, Atsuko's mom, and in another chapter, the kids. So I interviewed the kids of people who grew up this way. So I met Atsuko's mother. Her name was Michi. And I said, oh, can I interview you? And she was like, sure. You know, she's very cheerful. And so I was like, oh, tell me about how wonderful or something. I was like, tell me about Atsuko's life. And she's like, I hate the way she lives. I'm like, what? She's like, it's terrible. She should be normal. She should make more money. She should live a normal life. I don't know why she wants to live that way. And so I said to Atsuko, like, what do you think about it? She's like, oh, yeah, I know she thinks that. It's natural for a mother to worry about her children's economic situation, as if she was scolding me for being so dense. But she's a very normal person and very innocent. She completely accepts society's way of thinking as it is given to her. She listens to what everyone around her is saying without logically thinking about what is the better choice. And she adopts the normal world's definition of success. And she's very typical for her era. So then I ask Atsuko, is this what you meant about not wanting a normal way of living? That's part of it, she says. Most people spend their time relating entirely to things that are made solely for the purpose of keeping the economy spinning, of making money for someone, such as television and television shows and eating food that's not good for them. And to get that money, everyone throws away their own time that was free before, even if the work they do is not useful. Everyone around them thinks it's natural and normal, even though they're incredibly busy. On the physical body level, moving around all the time, they are empty on the level of the spirit. So then I ask her, so why do they do it, do you think? Because they don't stop to consider. Why is it that I, as a human, am alive?
Such a powerful moment of the book, I feel like, in that way of like, ooh, am I considering enough? And just, again, it encapsulates also how much these people you describe are, and you write about, are just sick of being slaves of the money, you know, and really want their freedom back and their time back. And therefore, they go through great length, right? They're just going to eat whatever they grow. And if that's what's not available, then... If the rice didn't grow well that year, they're going to eat barley for a year, you know, that kind of thing. It's like, and you ask, right? You ask these questions like, don't you ever want to go to the supermarket? It's like, yeah, it would be kind of nice, but then I give up my freedom, right? Because then I have to make money. It's such like a clear decision these folks have made, right? Yeah. Of like, yeah, this is my value, and I'm not giving up my time just to make money and then to buy more stuff. And then we all know how that goes.
Yeah. So one of the things when I've given like almost 100 talks on this book, and after a while, one of my friends actually showed up and he's like, so, well, maybe I don't need to even set it up that way. I realized that it wasn't just me going over at whatever I was in 1989, 25, thinking, okay, we all got to get back to land and we've got to, you know, grow our own food and, you know, got to, you know, whatever way a 20 person in their 20s thinks everyone should be. But when I got there, so many times people that I interviewed opened my eyes to this industrialized way of thinking that I had unconsciously adopted, and I didn't even know I was doing it. It's kind of true in writing too, is people have these absolutely productivity or, you know, information delivery views on how to write, and they don't even know that they have it because they've just been so immersed in it. So like there's one guy who took me to his tea house, which was an underground tea house that he dug out of the hillside that was also doubled as a fallout shelter in case there was a radioactive accident, and we're drinking tea, you know, in a Japanese tea ceremony, you know, the frothy matcha and like the, you know, flower arrangement and everything. And it's this very beautiful, quiet, spacious place. And then he looks at me and he says, nuclear power is totally inconsistent with the way of tea. And I was like, what? It's like the ideal of nuclear power is an endless amount of electricity lighting up every corner of the planet, whereas the ideal of the way of tea is one of humility and poetic sentiments. And I realized at that moment, of course I wanted lots of electricity, right? You know, turn on lights, you know, cheerful, happy lights, you know. And I realized that, you know, my whole way of thinking was predicated on, you know, a massive industrial, you know, canned tomatoes, you know, whatever it is, this way of getting more by, you know, outsourcing the toxicity to someone else's life or to the natural world. So I'm emphasizing this because there was just time and again where, you know, I came in there with like, well, I know what's right. And I realized that these people were, you know, and not in a challenging way. They just talked about their own way of seeing. And I was like, oh, I am presupposing such an industrialized way. So as strange as it may seem, humility and poetic sentiments may actually really be one of our ways out, you know. And you don't have to be a poet, just this way of enjoying the beauty of, like the caller had said, the clouds and just watching them. Or as we came in today, we drove over the main stem of the Eel River and just standing on the bridge, we stopped, you know, rush into the radio interview. No, like stop on the bridge and just notice the quality of this river that is so ancient. And to me, that's what I think is partly meant by poetic sentiments, is just to really deepen into some of the mysteries that are around us. And you need the time to do that. And in order to make the time, you have to do design on your life so that you're not, you know, burdened by a whole bunch of responsibilities that you didn't even know you were getting into, or mortgages, or, you know, making a better life for myself by getting a 4-car garage instead of a 2-car garage. I mean, that's easy to make fun of, but aren't we all doing that in some way?
Yeah, and this is exactly what happened to me, right? Just what happened to you, just going to these people, obviously in a very deep way, but even just reading the book, for me, these questions really came up of like, I am a person who's pausing a lot of times during my days. And that those pause moments can be refined. And the questions, to really ask ourselves in a gentle, curious, open way, not in a judgmental way, but really asking ourselves, okay, what do I really want, right? Because if we chase the money, we think we want to buy something else. But perhaps it's something else we actually want. Yeah. Anyway. Yes, Andy, do you want to talk a little bit about that last chapter that you wrote?
Sure.
Or do you have something
else? No, that's fine. It's a little strange to talk about oneself in a way. I teach these memoir classes or classes where people write about their lives because anytime you frame it, then it becomes a series of words and it's less than what it is. Currently,
I mean, perhaps you just want to start with a passage.
Sure. Do you have
one? I don't know the 387 here.
Oh, I think that's more about them, but
It's about a transition into – yeah.
Yeah, let me see if I
can feel like that's it. Really – it's one of those passages that would really you kind of crystallized into five words.
Yeah. Sure. I'll read that passage and then maybe I'll see if I can transition from that into the way we actually
live. Did I interrupt you in your flow?
No. That's fine. So after interviewing each person one by one, writing so many drafts and articles about them, finishing a book, 15 years in the making, and giving so many talks, I have to ask myself this. What were the things that really challenged me, made me wake up to my way of thinking that presupposed an industrialized system in five words, gentle, small, humble, slow, and simple. Quote, sometimes just to touch the earth is enough for me, said Wakako Oe. Time and again, I keep finding myself being brought up short by how very gentle their approach was, in particular her no cultivation method. Simply giving the plants she wanted to grow a little boost by cutting the weeds down a bit could be a metaphor for everything. From how to teach a child, when to take your bike somewhere instead of your car, or what kind of policy a local political representative might propose. So yeah, that sometimes just to touch the earth is enough for me. We are involved in growing our own food, and sometimes I will catch myself just, you know, thinking, okay, I have half an hour left before my class, and I've got to, you know, get these, you know, lettuce starts in or, you know, deal with the compost and just slowing down into that way of being again and again because it's a practice. So in terms of daily life.
So I do think
we have
a caller. Is that correct? Yeah.
Oh.
Go ahead, caller. Hello. Welcome to Mindful Mud.
Yes. I came in in the middle of it, and I heard this about purity, and my mind just went to, well, what purity is and what purity is not, and this is what I came up with. Purity is locked up inside the depths of an ice age glacier. Purity is not a slice of white bread with the crust cut off.
That's great. Thank you.
You're welcome. I enjoy your show. Thank you.
Thanks, caller.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just appreciate that call. Mm-hmm. So let's see. What can I say about the way we live? I try to keep my working for money at about 20 hours a week. And I try to take maybe every fifth week completely off to do free writing, which is one of the things I love, writing from the subconscious, one of the things I teach, but also just I do for myself a lot of time for reflection. Try to make sure I get 8, sometimes 9 hours of sleep every night. We live on a parcel of land about an hour from Garberville, so a long drive. We drink some great Earl Grey tea in the morning and listen to a little poetry recording. If anyone listens to the Writer's Almanac anymore, he reads a poem. He's a really good. And then we'll read a few poems to each other and gaze out at the valley. And then we'll do yoga. And sometimes I'm picking up a Qigong practice, which is a slow Chinese movement practice for those who don't know what Qigong is. I just found out that you're a Qigong teacher, Florina. But
that's a little much said.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
I'm teaching Qigong. How about that?
Okay. You're teaching Qigong. We live in it's now 2 rooms. My partner has her own office for her homeopathy business, but it's 24 by 26 feet. It's a bit crowded sometimes. So there's a constant process of trying to live with less. We try to get out walking on the property. We live at 2,700 feet, north-facing slope, a lot of water there. Trying to currently looking for a publisher for my adventure novel, my ecological adventure novel, my next book. And I work with my students in book completion groups and like to have a lot of time to talk with friends. That's really nourishing and enriching. We have a dog. We don't have any domestic animals. We grow a lot of our own food. We like to try to travel to a warm place because we're very interested in ways of living in the global south. And that's, I guess, part of our life is living simply there and trying to give back to those communities when we go. There's a little thumbnail of how I live.
That's a lot. It's very fast-paced.
Sometimes
description.
It is, yes.
It's interesting because so you got – I just thought it was very interesting how you had from the very early you had a vision. I feel like I don't want to – like I want a piece of land and live simple, right?
Yes, yeah.
Because you got your land in your 20s, is that correct?
Was it 90? Yeah, the 29.
I actually just ran yesterday in one of the realtors that you talked about with when you were young.
Yes, that's why I'm here. Marcy Ebert has changed our life by saying, yeah, there's some property out here.
Right.
But what's your question about the
– So just where did that knowing come from that you wanted to live
I will try to answer it, but I want to just point out that I think we really our deepest motivations are probably unknown to us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can explain things around them.
Correct.
I talk about this a little bit in the afterword. I mean, there was everything from you know, my mom's family was I think you'd have to call them bourgeois, you know, and there was people who my grandmother, you know, there was a woman who would serve at the table when we had Passover. And even as a 4 or 5 year old boy, the way that my grandmother, and she was a nice person, I'd want to be negative toward the ancestors, but there was a way that I felt when she picked up this little bell and rang it sort of aggressively to call this person from the kitchen to take our plates away or, you know, do the work that we didn't want to do as opposed to doing it all ourselves or inviting her to sit down at the table with us. I couldn't articulate it at the time, but it just didn't feel right. It felt, you know, basically hierarchical, you know, where each person's human dignity was, you know, graded on whoever had the access to more money. That was part of it. My dad and to a lesser extent, my mom always wanted to go out to nature and the West. And we grew up in Washington, D.C., and so we would go out in the mountains, just spoke to me. And then I had a friend when I was in college who told me that there were people who were living this way. It was in Southern Oregon, a little community up there that we went and visited, and it was just so rich. It was just so wonderful. Like people would run down in the middle of the summer to jump in the creek and, you know, shriek with the coldness of the water and then, you know, have this big meal and maybe play music. And, you know, it's just very different from the, you know, my family's from New York City. And I could just see that I went to a camp where we learned a lot of camp craft for boys. And there's just a lot of threads that came together. But I think in some sense it was just a feeling that, you know, it's interesting, a bumper sticker I saw some years ago. It says, everybody wants to get back to nature, but nobody wants to drive. Nobody wants to walk. Everyone wants to get back to nature, but nobody wants to walk. So there's this sort of like jump in a car and get to nature thing that urban people.
Yeah, and then build a big house.
Yeah, right.
And you didn't build a big house. You got your piece of property and then you both built the house together with hand tools.
Yes. Yeah, let me talk about that a little bit. So first of all, Cynthia was a primary carpenter. Often people assumed the other, more of the grunt. The idea of just bringing I don't know, one writer said it's people are living suburban lives just with a longer driveway, you know, and, you know, it's also unquestioned, but, you know, they get very busy or they get into a lot of debt to buy the land. It's one of the reasons we were so far out. We thought, oh, well, live near San Francisco. We can go back and forth. Well, but we didn't want to have any debt, you know, so we ended up, you know, 5.5-6 hours from the Golden Gate Bridge, which at first we were like, oh, what a drag, but it's really been much better in many ways. So humility and just creating this, I don't know, I use machines. You know, we bring in our firewood with a chainsaw. It's my one, you know, power tool. You know, how much do you want to take on? How, you know, the scream of the motor, the petroleum basis of the generator that runs the motor, and just, you know, back to handwork, just to like what you learn. You know, it's, I mean, people have gym memberships, right, to like keep themselves healthy. And that's not a bad thing necessarily if you're living in the city, but why not do productive work when you can? And I just also need to mention that, you know, I'm not saying that I'm better than anyone else or that everyone can live this way. There's certainly a you know, quite a bit of privilege. We all living with some element of it. So where can we let go of the privilege that we could take, especially when we know that it directly or indirectly causes so much harm all over the world, to live with less and actually be happier?
Yeah, and it's, again, it's not just, I don't know, a philosophy that we're talking here, right? It's really also a way of being able to live sustainably. It can be a way out, yeah, and a way in into not just suffering, oh, now we can't have what we want, but realizing the deep nourishment that comes from that, yeah. It really made me think of, you know, in a way we need that already inner calling or inner curiosity or inner nourishment to let go of more, if that makes, like, and when we do let go of all the distraction, there comes more nourishment. So again, it's that, it's the cycle from either trying to get more and more and more and more and more and more happiness through things, or less and less and less and more and more fulfillment because of that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, yeah, making these decisions. And sometimes it's just a small step we make, right? Yeah. Yeah, another thing that it made me think, you know, it's like, okay, how can I do less in my garden? Like... Because there was, I mean, all of these folks are such incredible gardeners, right? Which is really one of my, it's probably my biggest hobby. And really thinking, okay, how can I stress out less? Because I come from a mom who also had the best, like her major gardening was her, a hobby was her garden, but she was stressed out about it 24/7. And I feel like I've gotten already way better at that. And now I'm thinking, how can I let even more go? And this book really gave me some good inspiration to do that. Yeah.
Nice, nice.
Yeah, I think the title is excellent for this book. Yeah, do you want to talk a little bit before we have to wrap it up in a few minutes about your writing workshops that you're teaching?
Sure. Yeah, let me just to connect it to the book.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So just in case people are interested, I teach through The Opening, which I've been running as a solo venture primarily for about 28 years, and it's theopening.org, and I teach now almost all online, but I do love doing things in person. Yeah, I teach book completion groups, and I teach writing from the subconscious groups, and there's a little passage from the book which connects with this theme, I think, page 396. In my writing classes, it's essential to create large chunks of slow time. I believe that the subconscious is the richest region for writing, and being in a rush just shuts that door. Having a long, slow class and a lack of hierarchy parentheses, giving grades or distinguishing the real writer from the aspiring writer. All that allows each person to range freely inside of their own psyche. There's a continued emphasis on openness, on abundance, on plenty. I'm constantly trying to build my students' resolve to stay connected with what they are trying to communicate, even if it's just emerging and not completely clear to them. Rather than escaping into consumerism, how much more nourishing to connect with each other and to connect with the richness of language. So, yeah, I mean, that's – I lucked out to have just this job that is – you know, I've helped hundreds of people finish their books, and there's books out there in the world that, you know, I had a part in making. So it's not just about me publishing my own books. The small classes, and people get a chance to read to each other and share what's just emerging in a non-competitive and non-critical way. So I just encourage, you know, whether you contact me or not, if you do love writing, you know, find a friend and read them your work and have them give you feedback about what they liked or what they remembered or what it brought up for them, as opposed to how they would fix it or how they should change it or, you know, how they could grab the steering wheel from you, but more be alive to what's trying to happen through it. And it's just a really great way to spend time with each other and a deep way to connect to our humanity, because we are linguistic primates in many ways. And language is very much part of who we are.
I love how you bring that connection piece, right? Connection is really where it's at. Mm-hmm. And a lot in the book, that feeling came through. If we slow down, we also can deeper, we can have different connections. And in these days, we're, it's kind of the opposite of what's actually happening for most people, right? It's like this fast-paced life. Everybody's struggling. People think, I don't have enough. The lack, right? And the destroying of the planet and all this stuff that then we become overwhelmed and completely disconnected from ourselves and everything we could do. And then in the other way of like, okay, if we actually do slow down, connect with what's there, connect with the health, connect with each other, there's such healing. There's such incredible also inspiration. And And one of them, who was it, who wrote about the new myth, right? Masanori Oe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have to write that new myth if we want to. Let's see. I think I have a quote from him. I love that one. We need to create a new kind of myth, a new story we tell ourselves about why we are here, to make a world that does not create wars. Everything that exists ultimately is a material at all, because it is created entirely from relationship.
Mm.
Right?
That's a beautiful quote, yeah.
Yeah, it's entirely created through relationship. And I bet, like with writing workshop, because it comes out from your own inner self, then you create this connection. Yeah? Would you say that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's... it's about listening carefully as much as you can to where the person wants to go. There's a guy who's joining my classes from Costa Rica, and he had never been interested in poetry. He had a background in, you know, Harvard School of Government, and he had a connection with, like, he used to work as an engineer in Black and Decker in the United States. And now he realized that he wanted to write poems, and, you know, and so if he really wants to challenge himself, I'm ready to do that, listen to that. But someone else might have a book that they just want to figure out why they're blocked about finishing it, and then listening to that, to what reason is, they may not want to necessarily stretch as widely as they could. And so you know, listening, you can deepen your capacity to listen carefully throughout your whole life, you know, really try to see what you can guess is happening inside of another person from the clues of not just the words that come out of their mouths, but just their gestures or what's not said or their pauses or their hesitations or where they stop a sentence. So that kind of listening to the relationship they're having between their verbal self and the interior that might be mixed up with shame or, you know, overweening ambition or imposter syndrome or a million different things that are happening. So,
and giving each other that space of being listened to. Is what a gift. Yeah, and again, it's out of that, I feel, comes so much creativity in itself. I mean, writing is an outlet of creativity. We have to start to wrap it up slowly. Do you want to give your information for people again and how they can find a book and how they can get in touch with you?
Sure. The book's called The Abundance of Less. My name is Andy Couturier, and there you can go on to bookshop.org or Thrift Books. They do carry it in Arcata at Northtown Books, and a bit of discussion with the folks at Chautauqua. They carried the previous version some years ago. Maybe we'll see if we can get it into Chautauqua. There's lots of places to find it online. You can also read some excerpts and hear some of my other interviews at theabundanceofless.com. And if you are interested in writing classes, I do offer free classes once a month or so. And you can just join those on Zoom or by telephone. But you would sign up on the mailing list at The Opening. That's theopening, theopening.org. And yeah, feel free to reach out. And if you are interested, I always offer 20, 30-minute free consultations on people's writing if they'd like to get some help. And main goal is to be helpful. And if people do want to take a class, that's great. I can tell them about it. But yeah, if you're on the list, you'll find out about the free classes. And yeah, if you see me on the street here in Garboville, say hello.
That's the thing with the radio, right? You don't have really a face out there, but people can look you up and get a face. For folks who don't know you yet. Yeah. Thank you so much, Andy, for sharing your wisdom, your insights, this book with us.
I'd like to say something. Florina offers these meditation sittings. She offers free classes. She doesn't even ask for, or she, maybe she forgets to ask for donations. But I mean, when I first came to one of your sittings, I think it was bad weather. There wasn't many people there, but you were absolutely committed to being of assistance to the people there and creating space. And it's just the value system that I really related to. And I just thank you. And then you're not getting paid for the radio show either. You're doing a lot of things just as on the gift economy. And that's what we really need to get back to. So I just think what you do embodies a lot of those principles.
Thank you, Andy. That's very kind. Yes, so I've been actually teaching that meditation class for 15 years.
When and
where? Wednesdays from 5 to 6:30 at the Dharma Center in Garberville. It's, well, I can throw the website out that the free link is on there. It's essenceoflifesangha.com. But you just find it also by just looking up my name and yeah. But thanks, Andy. Yeah, that's a special little group we're having there. And it takes that, it takes the group, it takes the connection, it takes the that the relationship. Yeah, everything's in relationship. I would like to go out with one last quote that's also from the book by Koichi Yamashita. Don't imitate our life, please. Learn from our life. Build up your own new life. Just be as much like yourself as you can be. Thank you so much.
This has been a K-Mite podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.